Love the poems. Love the stories. Love the words. On East Leeds Community Radio.
So you're listening to Love the Words here on East Leeds Community Radio, not from Chapel FM, but from my office in Meanwood. I'm going to be talking to the poet Sean Street. And hello, Sean, and where are you?
Hello, Peter. I'm talking to you from my home in Liverpool.
Marvellous. It's great to speak to you. And it was lovely to see you recently at the Charles Parker Day down in Birmingham. Tell us a bit about that to begin with and what you were doing there at the Charles Parker Day.
Well, Charles Parker Day and I go back a long way. In fact, Charles Parker Day originally was all my fault, I suppose, because when I was an academic at Bournemouth University, I'd worked in radio for many years then, and Charles Parker had always been a hero of mine, and the radio ballads and so forth. And then I discovered that Charles Parker had been born in Bournemouth, which was an absolute gift. So I decided, using some of my university's research centre funds, to fund a day, which was a day of celebration for Charles Parker. And the subtitle was the radio feature, Past, Present and Future, which it still is. And I'd sort of thought that was it, really. I thought, well, that's good. Lots of people came and lots of people remembered Charles Parker, and his daughter came along and so on. And it was a good day. And I thought, well, this is nice. Maybe we can do it again next year. And we did. And then somebody from Birmingham came along and said, we'll do it next year. So I said, great, you know, that's fine. And out of that has grown, well, more than 20 years of Charles Parker Day, moving around the country. It's kind of peripatetic. It moves to a different university every year. And since I've lived in Liverpool, since I left Bournemouth, which was about 14 years ago, I've always dreamt that it should come here to Liverpool, because it seemed to me that Liverpool is one of the perfect places to host Charles Parker Day. In fact, I think probably Leeds is also another great place to host Charles Parker Day. That hasn't happened yet. Maybe it will. But certainly Liverpool seemed to me to have Charles Parker's name on it. And I'd done some lectures at Liverpool University with Ellie Liebeck of the School of English and Irish Studies last year. And we talked about it. It turned out she was a great Charles Parker fan. So that brought it to Liverpool, which was a wonderful thing. And I was talking this year about another great hero of mine, the late Piers Plowright, who is a radio producer who I knew and loved for many years. We were personal friends, and he died in 2021. Recently I've been part of the process of setting up on the School of Sound website a series of recordings of his lectures. And really my purpose in Charles Parker Day this year, and indeed to anybody who'll listen, is to go to the School of Sound website and listen to Piers Plowright talking about radio, because there's frankly nobody better. So that's what brought me to Charles Parker Day this year.
Well, it was a fascinating day. It was great to hear those excerpts you played from Piers Plowright's lectures for School of Sound. And yes, they're all up there. Do have a listen. We're Tony and I are enjoying them immensely. Tony McAleese, so that's my colleague at Chapel FM Arts Centre now. But Sean, you've had a very illustrious career in radio, and you were the first professor of sound. If you could, I think I asked you about this last time. You're in Love the Words, but it'd be great to hear about that again before we get to your poetry.
Okay. Yeah. Well. My initial title was professor of radio, and I was the first professor of radio in the country. I'm not now. There are plenty of us around, but it's not just. I mean, latterly, of course, radio has become something. Part of something bigger, which is audio. We consume sound in all sorts of different ways now to the way we used to. Radio was something that used to come out of a radio. Radio sound was something that came out of a radio set. So the words had two meanings. Now we talk about audio, and I think it's all got a little bit more confused because we talk about podcasts and listening online and so forth. You know, I consume a lot of radio through online radio stations from the other side of the world. You know, one of my favorite radio stations is a jazz station in Seattle, which I listen to online all the time. So it's another world now. So it's broadened out, but it's still about sound. And it's still, at the end of the day, about creating pictures and about telling stories, which is, of course, one of the things that brings us back to poetry, because that's what poetry does as well.
Absolutely. And your latest collection is called Running Out of Time, and I've got a copy in front of me. I've been enjoying it greatly, so thank you for it, and I'm really looking forward to hearing about it. So I mean, it's yeah, well, we'll come to the themes. I think, Sean, if you could possibly read a poem from it straight away, that'd be lovely.
Well, yes, I'll do that. I'll read the very first poem in the book, which is a very short poem, which is called Breaking News. It happens on ordinary days, a bored pencil tapping a glass and the morning post leaking in, a desk light intent as a heron, downstream an angle poised bird aiming through indifferent reflections. And that little poem I wanted to put at the beginning because it's obviously got a couple of meanings. I mean, one meaning is obviously the big news in our lives, be they personal or be they international or national, come out of a clear blue sky. You know, there's never a warning when the big things happen. But it's also, I suppose, in a way, it's about the act of writing poetry. It's sort of my, if you like, referring to Ted Hughes, it's a bit like my thought fox, if you like. My thought fox is a heron in this poem.
There are quite a few short poems, actually, in the book. And the whole, I would say, the poems often have a very stripped down, lean quality to them. Is that something that is particular to this collection, or do you fade? Yeah, I mean, there are longer ones too, of course, but I noticed there are quite a few very short poems that really pack a lot in.
I think it is something that I'm, if I look back over the stuff that I've written over the last few years, I think I am moving more towards a kind of conciseness in the poetry. Is it conscious or not? I'm not sure. I think it's just something that I've often found that you know what, as I think often we do when we write poems, that we put them away after we've written them, and then we come back to them and find that the actual nub, the actual essence of the poem, is buried in maybe one quatrain in a dozen quatrains, and you suddenly realize, well, actually, that's what I was trying to say, and the rest of it is okay, and it may have earned its place, or maybe it hasn't. But more and more, I'm finding it has, you know, the brevity and the trying to get to the number of something quite briefly is quite important for me. And in fact, you're right, because the long poem, maybe we'll talk a bit about this at some point, but the long poem from which the book gets its name, Running Out of Time, which is the poem that finishes the book, is a long poem of about five or six pages or so. But it's actually written, each verse is written in haiku form. So it's a kind of, and that was a deliberate thing. I wanted to write a long poem about the environment and time and so forth, but at the same time use the briefest of forms, poetic forms, I could possibly find. So that was really a conscious thing to make the concise form of the haiku into a unit of a longer poem.
That's interesting. And I mean, the title is Running Out of Time, and that implies, and I hope you won't mind me saying, that this is a kind of a later work of yours, in the sense that Neither of us is very young anymore.
No, that's
But
true enough.
I'm interested in how late work in all mediums actually so can sometimes does have a sort of stripped down, a leaner, more economical kind of quality. I'm thinking of, the although Louis MacNeice was only 60 odd when he died, his last collection was which I love actually is quite different from he loved the longer form, but so I'm just wondering if that's something that resonates with you in terms of, I'm also thinking of Beethoven's late quartets actually as well.
Yes. I think it is. I think the title "Running Out of Time" is deliberately ambiguous in a way. I mean, certainly, it's a. I mean, the an overall theme in the book is about the environment and what we're doing to the planet and so forth. So there's that kind of urgent message, I hope, is in there. So in that sense, we're running out of time. And it would be disingenuous of me to say that it's not about personal mortality as well, as you rightly say. We're all of us more and more increasingly conscious of that. So it's about that too. But I think it's also, and I intend this ambiguity that it's about the idea that we're actually, in some ways, we have the capacity to leave time behind, to escape from time. And it may be through, for some people, meditation. It may be through listening to music where time stands still, for us. Or it may simply be just the idea that time is not perhaps the thing we've always thought it was. It's maybe it's a layered thing or whatever. That's a kind of riff that goes through it, I suppose, is the idea that time is something to escape from, or we can perhaps escape from, even momentarily. I think the other thing that I've noticed, looking back on this book from the point of view of looking at how the book poems were put together over the months, is that one of my fascinations is connecting the visible with the invisible. I mean, there are several poems in the book that try to do that, that take a physical object as being something that connects one to, I don't know, a loved one who's passed on or whatever it might be. But it's a link, it's a physical thing that links us to that. May I read a poem that illustrates
Please
that?
do. Please do. I was going to invite you to do that. I was actually
This
just
is,
looking at guitar, but which is a about an object. But do read, do read, do
well,
read
let's do
that straight away.
guitar. Guitar was is a poem about a chap who I first met when I was at school called Chris Cartledge, and he and I. Well, we did what lots of teenagers do. We played in a band at the time, but it was Chris who really introduced me to playing the guitar, and it's been a lifelong love of mine. It's a hobby. I don't profess to be a great guitarist, but I love the guitar as an instrument. I love all its voices, and this is, as you say, this is a poem in which the physical object links me to the memory of him. Chris passed away a few years ago now. It's just simply called Guitar. Then you smiled and handed the guitar to me. And to this very day, I see the flash over strings, sun splash where it has always been, in the green museum of myself I built to keep safe spilt remnants I still curate, an archive sifted from beneath these layers of time. We were players together, tuning, staying tuned. We prized the touch and shine of them. No guitar now, but the sound of air between us, harmonics brushing across strings, a wind harp. And I think that's exactly what I'm trying to say, really, is this idea that the physical object connects us to things that we can't touch.
Yes, I find those, especially those last two lines, very poignant, very moving, just because, of course, we when you get to a certain age, one has lost people and lost people.
Yes.
And so, yeah,
Yes.
I really like that. And yeah, I mean, the word time does crop up a great deal actually in the collection all the way through, sometimes with a capital T and sometimes not.
Yes,
But
yes.
also, there are quite a few dedicated poems within it, and more than one usually sees actually.
Yes. Yeah. I think that, and I think that's part of the same point, really, that as one gets older, one does say goodbye to more and more people, and so one finds oneself remembering them through a poetry. It's Elizabeth Jennings said something about that in one of her poems too, and I do think that we do inevitably. I mean, many of these poems are consolatory poems too for people and for friends who've lost loved ones too. I've been conscious that a number of people who I've known have lost partners or whatever it may be, and in some cases these poems were written by way of sharing their grief, I suppose, and so yes, there's a lot of personal poems in here, but I hope they are have a universality about them. But they do carry there are a number of, you're right, there's a lot of dedications in here.
Well, I'd love you to read Building a Cairn, which is one of my favorites. And that's a dedication to Julian May, who, of course, is still very much in the world as a producer on
Yes.
Radio 4 and Radio 3. But yes, but please do read that if you would.
Yes, I'll tell the story behind this, because Julian and I have made many, many radio programs together over the years, and still fortunately do make programs together from time to time. But this came about through a radio program we made in Newfoundland some years ago at Cupid's Bay, which is on the east coast of Newfoundland. And Cupid's Bay was the place where the first permanent English settlement was set up. By a man called John Guy for the Bristol Merchant Venturers back in 1612, right about that time. And what Guy was creating a settlement for was really the rich fisheries, the cod banks off the coasts of Newfoundland. The idea was purely a mercantile one, that to set up, if you can set up a permanent base there, rather than come in every year when the weather improves, you're first out on the fishing fields. So that was why that was established. We went to make a radio program there because the original settlement was being excavated, of Guy's settlement. So we went to make a radio program there, and it's a beautiful place. And I know I'm a bit disabled, so I'm a bit stuck when it comes to climbing hills and things like that. But Julian's a great walker and climber. And Cupid's Bay is surrounded by high hills. And one of the archaeologists on one occasion said, "Do you fancy going for a walk?" And Julian said, "Yeah." So he went up onto the top of this hill, and I was down in the bay waiting for him, and I could see these tiny figures moving across the top of this hill to the top where there is a cairn, and he put a stone on it. And I was building my cairn of words, because I couldn't build my cairn of stone. So building a cairn for Julian May, Cupid's Cove, Newfoundland. Up on the height that overlooked the bay, they'd built an obelisk of rocks, each climber adding to the pile to prove that they'd been there. "I saw you from the road as you made your way up to what I could never have hoped to get, that view beyond a bobbing bath toy boat, a snail bus weebling the road, as I sat and wrote this. And me, a dot watching your stick man silhouette place its stone, which for all I know is up there still with all the rest, weathering and playing its part in the recording of custom at the heart of place. To have been a presence there on Cupid's Hill. Instead of which, I've just this heap of words that's mined from where I stand, a shape of sorts for someone else to find.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you very much, Sean. That's Sean Street reading from Running Out of Time, latest collection. And yes, there's also from Newfoundland, that there's a poem about Doncaster. I was wondering, I was going to ask you about Doncaster, Sean. I didn't know you had a connection there.
Well, I mean, for anybody who remembers or has read my last collection, which in a way this is a kind of sequel to, the last collection from Shoestring was called Journey into Space. And that again was a kind of dual meaning, I suppose. It's based on a science fiction program from the 1950s. It's about space and in the sense of astronomy, but it's also about the spaces we inhabit and the spaces we occupy and the spaces we move into. And in that book, there's a poem called Journey into Space, which is about my childhood, which is a childhood spent moving all around the country. According to where my father got promoted to, we all went. Now, that's how it worked. You know, my dad was kind of really upwardly mobile in the 50s, and that was it. Which is fine, except that it means that the young boy is constantly having to readjust to different schools, always the new boy, and always having an accent that doesn't quite fit. And that was my fate. So moving to Sheffield, as we did, from the Isle of Wight, you can't really imagine much more of a culture shock than that, I suppose. And that's what we did. So yeah, that's what Journey is. But my refuge was in, once a week, there was this science fiction series with aliens who seemed, if anything, I could identify with, because they were kind of strange too, if you see what I mean. So yes, I return to that in this book, in a two poem sequence. I only could read one of them, but called The Sputnik Year, which was 1957. And Bruce Duncan was my you know, when you go to a new school, if you're a new boy, there's usually one boy who or one person who befriends you, and you cling to them because it's a hand of friendship that is in a strange world. And Bruce was my hand of friendship. He was my savior. And Platform One Doncaster Station came out of the fact that Bruce was a train spotter. Now, I'd never been train spotting in my life. I didn't know what it was all about. I had no idea. Your new friend says, I'm going train spotting. Do you want to come? You say, yeah. You know, anything to be part of something, you know. So we went from Sheffield to Doncaster on this freezing day. I remember this in 1957. It must have been November or December or something like that. And spent a day on the platform writing down train numbers. And I had no idea why I was writing down train numbers. I was just informed that's what you did, you know. And this was, of course, the golden age of steam. And we were told that, you know, the Mallard and all the great northbound trains rushed through there at some point of the day, but it was foggy, so we never saw them. And out of it all came Platform One, Doncaster Station. Given hindsight, it was Coal's golden age. But at the time, there was no reason I could see to be there, apart from outstaring the Doncaster fog and turning iron cold. So cold, it grew welts on my hands, never before or since so cold that I couldn't think. But Great Northern's iced weft and weave of patterning rails hypnotized, mesmerized with its percussive shunting music, points snap decisions, promising tints of posted places beyond the rain as we listened in vain for Mallard ghosting through the mist. Doncaster, we shared together our post-war early spring for one coal-smutted day, our eyes flustered to tears by smoke, captains on the deck of Platform One, prow pointing to seas of mysterious tracks, wondering when the sleet allowed, where the lines might lead us down their clattering distances.
Well, lovely. Yeah, thank you very
Thank you.
much, Sean.
Yeah.
Let's have a piece of music. You've chosen the overture from the Magic Flute, and yes, it would be great if you could. I know there's a poem connected with this, but perhaps we could have the music first and then the poem.
Yes, let's do that. This is the overture from Mozart's Magic Flute.
So that was the Overture to the Magic Flute, chosen by the poet Sean Street, who we're talking to today on Love the Words. And Sean, yeah, tell us about the poem in the collection Running Out of Time, which is your latest collection, that is connected with that piece of music.
Yeah, well, the poem is called Colosseum Nights, and it refers to the London Colosseum on St Martin's Lane, London, which is actually sort of very current at the moment because this has been the home of English National Opera for many, many years. And as you know, controversially, they're losing that home. They're being rehomed in Manchester, but for many people, it is the end of an era, and for me too, really, because this refers to the epigraph on this poem says 1969, because that was the time that my wife Jo and I, just before we got married, and I was then working as an actor in London, and we were poor as church mice. We really were. But in 69, it used to cost 5 shillings to get a ticket to go to sit in the gods at the Colosseum. And we used to go. I mean, we'd forego a meal. Was 5 shillings was 5 shillings in 1969. And we'd forego a meal and go to the opera. And we talk about this often, even now, the two of us, because that's still something that we remember vividly, vividly the spectacle, seeing it, this tiny stage from this vertiginous drop of the gods out there, where you felt you would likely to fall off a cliff. but it was magical. And in so and the, we saw many operas. We saw Rossini and Thieving Magpie, and many others. But the one that I suppose this poem is really about is a memory of Mozart's Magic Flute, and going to see that. So this is Coliseum Nights, St. Martin's Lane, London, 1969. When for 5 shillings we sat among gods, watching, vertiginous, the small blessed world staged and glowing, lime-lit far below us. Never was flute so magic as when it rose up at our feet, echoing along the reflecting homeward street. The pavement's glass, we two aiming ourselves beyond rain into a life we had yet to invent. Flying from that great height, into the space beyond us, pure with possibility. We shared then a perfect trajectory across unmade days, through new built air, in shapes carved out by no one before us. For we were 5 shilling gods, come from sky, invincible, with what seemed immortal songs in our own follow spot, for a short season.
Oh, lovely. Thank you, Sean. Yes, and while we're on music, one of my favourites in the collection is She Makes Music, which I really enjoy. And it's another short poem, but I wondered if you could talk about and read that.
Yes, I mean, this is a different kind of music altogether from Mozart. Maria Kovacevic is a composer and a musician. She lives in Brooklyn, New York. And I came to her work through a mutual friend of mine, Carol Beer, who I used to live with in Paris many, many years ago. And he introduced me to the work of Maria. And I was immediately fascinated by her work. She Makes Music refers to what she does, because Maria just actually collects broken violins that are broken beyond repair, and she somehow makes sound out of them again. She doesn't repair them, she takes them as they are and maybe restrings them if that's necessary, but the violin in whatever form it is still has a life. And I love the kind of metaphor in that, because, you know, we're all kind of as we get older, broken violins, aren't we? But we hopefully still have some kind of a voice. It may be a bit cracked. It may not sound as it did, but it. I love the idea of the possibility that it can still make music. So this is, yes, you're right. It's only 6 lines, but this is She Makes Music. She makes music from broken violins, and their songs can break a heart when she lets them sing. Only unmendable violins, because what broke them is now what makes them sing.
Yes. I think that's a really, really interesting idea. Yes. I mean, it sort of evokes, actually, and I'm trying to, if I might be misremembering, the two songs, one by Bob Dylan and one by Leonard Cohen, is the famous one about the cracks letting the light in. I don't know if you know that song, Sean.
Yes. Yes.
But also, I remember Bob Dylan croaking away, everything is broken. I remember.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah,
it's true, isn't it? It's true. And I do think that, probably a fiddle player or a cello player or whatever it may be, even when you buy a new pen, it has to be broken in. It has to find you. There's a kind of mutual coming together until it sits in your hand comfortably, and it starts to learn how to write your way or to sing your way. It's back to the idea, I suppose, of the invisible and the visible, and the physical. Touching, coming together.
Yes, absolutely. Just to say something, the last thing about that, I mean, I think there's something, you know, it's our breakages, it's the fact we're broken, it's the ways we're broken that gives us we have more to say when we've lived a bit, I suppose, as I take some comfort from that.
Yes, yeah, I think so. I think it's what broke them is now what makes them sane,
Yeah,
you know.
exactly.
Yeah.
I see a kinship between that poem and Digging Out the Stream, which is another poem I really enjoyed. And I wonder if you can, this is turning into a bit of a request show here, I'm afraid.
That's all right. I mean, you're the first person, don't really, and your audience are the first person people to hear these poems because the book only came out a month ago, you know. So I'm interested to know what poems draw people to them because you know as a poet yourself, you know, you become very close to stuff and you don't know what's going to appeal to anybody else, you know. It's But Digging Out a Stream, yes. I mean, it's again, as you rightly say, this is another way of saying almost the same thing, really, that you can polish something up, and it may look better, or it may be more efficient, but it maybe doesn't have the same music about it in a way. Digging Out the Stream. Stones in a shallow stream, obstructions, disruptions, make options. Distract flows thought as it hits a chipped ridge, changes the rushed splash of soundings, happenstance, the music of encountering pebble and rock. Take out scree, shape gullies, deepen, narrow, form a certainty from possibilities, break down chance, teach water efficiency. Without shale and shingle, it will run smoother. Sing less.
Yes, I like that very much. Yes, the things that it'll run smoother and be more efficient in some ways, but yes, sing less. Great stuff. Let's hear. I'm interested to hear Obad, and I don't know if you. I mean, it would be great to also hear a section from Running Out of Time.
Yeah, I think there's two. I could happily switch between or kind of segue between those because I think they are central to one of the themes in the book. Obad is interesting in the sense that it's also the lyric of a piece of music. I work a lot with the composer Cecilia McDowell, who's an English choral composer, wonderful musical choral composer. And a couple of years ago, Cecilia was commissioned by the Ealing Choral Society, of which she's the president, to write a work for their 60th anniversary. And it's she wrote a work called Bird of Time, which is a three-movement piece. And she, as I say, we've collaborated on a number of projects together. And she asked me to write a couple of poems for that. And Obad was already kind of in the process of being written when she asked me, so I was able to really just adapt it a little bit for her music. I'd request that music to be played now, but it has yet to be recorded. It's being recorded, I think, next month, by, I believe, Merton College Choir, but it's not out there yet. But in the meantime, this is the poem, and it's about, as is so much of this, a kind of elegiac poem, really, for the loss of avian species. The birds were losing the different voices that are disappearing from our skies and from our trees. Obad. Air made audible. Out of darkness, song before flight, before wing. Dawn song before everything. A music maker for those who sang, for the diminishing choir, less in each unfeathering hour. Absence visible. And morning song haunting silence past repair, filling space where their voices were. And to move from Obad to the last poem, the long poem at the end of the book, Running Out of Time, which is a poem in eight sections. And as I mentioned earlier, it's a long poem, but it takes as its kind of components. The idea of the haiku as a unit of verse. And if I may, I'll just read the last three sections because those three sections together, I think, link the two themes, the idea of running out of time in the temporal sense of losing the planet, And also the idea of running out of time as escaping from time, stepping outside of time. So this is starting with part six of this eight-part poem. I said to summer, "You burn too hot for comfort." Said summer, "Your choice." Then I said to spring, "How many leaves are there left?" Said spring, "Ask autumn." I said to winter, "You are a mere duration." Said winter, "You too." Part seven. Running out of time, through all the matter of it, leaving time behind. The matter matters only in its duration. Running outruns it. I run out of time, leaving matter to itself, the clutter of it, a new radiance, a timeless continuance, timeless, no matter. And part eight is the only part of this long poem that has a title. And the title is Scarlet, and it refers to the heroine of Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. She said, "Tomorrow is another day." Perhaps. Not a given.
Those are the last words in the collection as well. Well, thank you, Sean. I mean, so, but I'll ask you in a minute about where we can get hold of the book and so on. And also, I'm going to ask you to read one final poem which connects to a piece of music. But first of all, before we do that, are you busy on other projects at the moment? Are you, what else are you up to?
Well, I'm having a kind of break really at the moment. I've there've been some personal circumstances at home that have kept me from the desk a bit. You know, health issues and so forth. So I've not been very busy over the last few months. But having said that, I'm perhaps having a bit of a reaction because Running Out of Time came out, as I say, in March. Prior to that, last July, Bloomsbury published a long prose book of mine called Wild Track, excuse me, I'll just get a copy of it off the shelf because I can't remember what the subtitle of it is. Wild Track is a book called with the subtitle Sound, Text, and the Idea of Birdsong. And this book took a lot out of me, actually, because I, as you know, I've worked in radio almost all my life, really, recording programs. And I had one of those idle thoughts that come to one occasionally as somebody who's relied on, first of all, reel-to-reel tape, and then digital tape, then mini discs, and now memory cards to record material. So recording right through all these different media, how was the natural world recorded before we could record it physically with a machine? The sounds of it. And of course, the answer is words. And it was that challenge that was met from writers, from Seneca to Ted Hughes. And we're still doing it. We're still, however sophisticated our recording equipment may be, we still try to write down not just the sound, but the effect the sound has on us. And that's the key thing. A recording machine can record you the sound of a blue tit or a blackbird or whatever it may be, but it can't record how it felt to hear it. And that's why we go on writing. And so that's what this book is about. It's about the act of recording sound in our minds and in our hearts. And as is often the case, when you're writing a piece of prose, the ideas in that bleed over into the poetry. And so I would probably say that Running Out of Time wouldn't have happened if I hadn't written Wild Track first last year. And that came out in July last year. And you know, so I did challenge myself, having written a book about how poets try to recreate sound in words. There's a tiny poem which, if I may, I'll just diverge by reading in this, where I did challenge myself that. I thought, well, Okay, Street, you've written about trying to write the idea of recording a sound in words. How would you do it? So I wrote another tiny poem, 5-line poem, called Wren Song, which was a direct answer to that challenge in myself. Almost beyond hearing, this thread of hedge that quivers more notes than Art Tatum, bird jazz at the speed of light, shivers of invisible silver. And that's my answer to my own challenge to try to write the impression of a wren. But I'm these days quite hard of hearing, and a lot of the top frequencies are a bit of a challenge to me now. But thanks to technology, I'm now able to once again hear the wren song. So it's lovely to hear it
I
again.
think you answered your own challenge.
Thank you.
So yes, in terms of that, that's Wild Track, and that's available from Bloomsbury, presumably, and all the places you'll find a book, really, yeah, presumably. And shoes, this is Running Out of Time is published by Shoestring. They do a wonderful variety of things over the years. Fantastic publishing house. And where do we find that? The same sort of place?
I think, yeah, I mean, I think you probably find it in most places. Being a small press, I think, the online sources are the ones to look for. Shoestring's outlet is Central Books, so the Central Books website is easily searchable, and it carries both Running Out of Time and Journey into Space are both available through that, and through some of the other more conglomerate booksellers.
Yes,
But
indeed.
I'd start with Central Books because they're directly controlled by Shoestring Press in this instance.
Marvelous. Let's hear. Thanks ever so much, Sean, by the way. It's been lovely to speak to you again.
Thank you for having me, Peter. It's been a joy to talk to you.
Well, let's hear Contrapuntis, which I really like, and you can tell us about that perhaps before you read it. And then we'll hear the piece of music it refers to.
Right, yes. Well, this is I'm fascinated by the work of Glenn Gould, the pianist, the Canadian pianist Glenn Gould. He wasn't just a pianist, he was actually also a radio producer, made some extraordinary and very challenging radio documentaries in the late 50s and early 1960s, and notably the Solitude Trilogy. And he believed in contrapuntal radio. This is why they're challenging, because Gould was a rather strange character, and he believed that you should be able to listen to two voices overlapping one another in exactly the same way as you can listen to two musical instruments overlapping one another in a symphonic sense, which is all very well if you're Glenn Gould. It's a bit more challenging for the rest of us. But anyway, that apart, he was a legendary interpreter of the works of Bach, the piano works of Bach, the keyboard works of Bach. And Contrapuntis 14 is the last of the variations in Bach's Art of Fugue. And this poem refers to that work because there's a film of Glenn Gould playing this, made in CBC Studios Toronto in the spring of 1981. And for those who don't know this particular piece, it stops in mid-flight, it stops in mid-phrase, and there's nobody's ever really explained why that is, whether Bach died or at that point, or whether a person from Porlock came to the door, we don't know. We don't know why, but he never went back to it. And Gould in the film plays it, and it's miraculous because he doesn't anticipate this break in the middle of the phrase. He plays as if it's just going to go straight on, but it just stops. And in the film, very cleverly, the director of the film freezes Gould at the moment the music stops. And Gould plays what comes up to the last note, and where the silence of the note that should follow comes, Gould snatches his arm up as if he's been given an electric shock. And at that moment, the film freezes. and then it slowly fades to black. It's the most extraordinary piece of audio visual I can think of, one of the most extraordinary moments in music I can think of. So the variation, which lasts about 12 minutes, maybe we'll hear maybe the last couple of minutes of it, which ends with that break. And anyone listening, no, you haven't lost your signal. That's where it stops, in the middle of a phrase. So that's what I'm trying to talk about, really, and explain and explore and discuss in this Contrapunctus 14, J.S. Bach, The Altar Fugue, film Glenn Gould, CBC Studios, Toronto, spring 1981. Bar 239, an eighth note D above middle C. It is that ends things in mid-air. And the picture freezes on screen, his hand suspended in time. Gould, Bach, past, present, to come, held together in music's arms, as though on the score was written that something should always be unfinished. For sound teaches us how to die, reaching toward the next note, the intention that stays unplayed inside us.